your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got quite a bit on our plate this evening. Quite a bit has been going on. We're going to be concentrating on the coronavirus, COVID-19. And also we're asking you over the next few days to come into killthevirus.world. So again, that's killthevirus.world. That's a new site we're putting up in conjunction with holding a live webcast from the University of Texas. And we're going to be attracting in some of the very finest minds that we have to comment and to give their expertise on this coronavirus outbreak, or COVID-19, they're calling it now. But first, we're going to start with some excerpts from President Trump's press conference today from the White House, and then we'll move on to additional information on the coronavirus outbreak. Here we go now with the president.
You mentioned you're having the meeting on Monday with the pharmaceutical executives. Right. As you know, the process of approving medicines is complex and time-consuming.
This process will go very quickly.
What powers will you use?
I think Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, this process is going to go very quickly. And you know, that was, excuse me?
The head of the FDA is here.
Yeah, we can do that.
We
want to do that?
We're expedited.
Okay, would you like to say something? All right.
Okay.
And the private companies, too, that you're talking about.
So we are working very diligently with industry. We're using our authorities in an expedited fashion to help with the development of therapeutics, particularly around the coronavirus. As you probably know, we issued a policy this morning that allows us to have a lot of flexibility around the development of diagnostic tests. Our colleagues at the CDC have done a great job to have an increase in those tests, and we expect this policy to have a significant impact on that as well. Thanks.
By the way, the meeting with the pharmaceutical companies was actually set up before over drug pricing, because we want prices to go way down. But it turns out to be a very convenient meeting as it pertains to the vaccine.
So you'll talk about both?
Talk about both.
Sir. Thank you, Mr. President. You put the vice president in charge of coronavirus coordination across the government. When he was governor of Indiana, the vice president allowed an HIV outbreak to spiral out of control because he did not heed the advice of his public health professional advisors, who said that a needle exchange was necessary at the beginning of the outbreak. What guarantee can you give Americans that political considerations and ideological issues will play no role in your government's response to this virus?
Well, let me just respond quickly, and then I'm going to have Mike say something about that, because I've heard very good explanations, actually. When it came to health care, Indiana has been a leader, an absolute leader, and it was really started with others, but by Mike Pence, and he's done a phenomenal job on health care, one of the best, if not the best, in the country. And with that, I'll let Mike respond specifically, if you want to.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. President. When I was governor of the state of Indiana, we actually had two experiences with the spread of infectious diseases. The first was in 2014, when Indiana was where the very first MERS case in the United States arrived. Obviously, an infectious disease much more deadly than the coronavirus that we're dealing with today. It was then, when I was governor, that I learned of the extraordinary capabilities of CDC. I worked with my health officials in the state of Indiana, worked with federal officials, and maybe most importantly, learned the invaluable role that local health officials play in dealing with the spread of infectious disease. I'm proud to say that the state of Indiana secured that patient, found out everyone they'd ever contacted. There were no additional infections, and that patient recovered. There was only one other MERS disease. The other incident was in 2015. We had an outbreak of HIV in a very small town that emerged in early 2015. My health officials came to me. We immediately deployed health resources. The truth was HIV/AIDS was being spread by people sharing needles in intravenous drug use. And the state of Indiana did not allow for providing a needle exchange to citizens. But the CDC came in and made a recommendation, and I declared a public health emergency and made for 30 days a needle exchange available in the state of Indiana. And I'm proud to say that every one of those patients was treated. We ended the spread of the HIV/AIDS virus in that community. But again, as I've said before, I think, as the President and I have discussed, I think my experience as a governor dealing with two different infectious diseases and seeing the vital role that local health care providers play, that federal officials play, it has really informed me. It's one of the reasons why I've been spending a lot of time talking to governors. I met yesterday with state health officials and the governor in Florida, and I'm proud of the work that we did in the state of Indiana, and I hope to continue to bring all of the best minds together to deal with this issure.
It's a great answer, and he's doing a great job. Go ahead. He's doing a great job. Great answer. Thank you.
2 days ago, 36 Turkish soldiers were killed in Idlib, Syria, and today Turkish foreign...
When was that? When?
2 days ago.
Okay.
And today, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu said Turkey wants a Patriot air defense system from the United States. Are you in talk with Turkish government regarding...
We're speaking to President Erdogan a lot, and we are talking to him about exactly what you're referring to.
Are you able to do anything from a policy or a reassurance standpoint to try to deal with...
The markets will all come back. The markets are very strong. The consumer is unbelievably strong. The companies are very strong. We have one problem. We have to get this problem brought into focus, and it is right now. I think our professionals are doing a great job. I'm not thinking in terms. Well, it's certainly not a good situation. When you lose travel, that's a big part of market. But for a period of time, we're going to have to do whatever is necessary. Safety, health, number one. The markets will take care of themselves. The companies are very powerful. Our consumer has never been in a better position than they are right now. Larry Kudlow was telling me before that the numbers, I said, don't even bring it up. What difference? But that the numbers are very strong. He's got numbers from Friday, very strong. You see the numbers. But our focus is on exactly this. It's not on that. That will take care of itself.
Are you considering any tax breaks to help ease the pain?
I think the big thing we're looking for is the Fed to do its job. If the Fed does its job, that's what we are really looking for. Prior to this, we announced that we're going to be at the end of the year. We're going to be toward the end of the year. We're going to be announcing a middle income tax cut. In order to get that through, I don't think the Democrats are going to be approving any tax cuts because they like to raise taxes instead of lower taxes. But we'll be in the not too distant future announcing a very major middle income tax cut. Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Go ahead, please.
People started to buy hand sanitizer and food supplies and also medical supplies to prepare, and there are news about some of the items are out of stock. Do you think they should get prepared and also...
I think it's always good to be prepared. I think it's always good, but we are super prepared. When you hear 43 million masks, as an example. All right, we'll do one more. Go ahead, the gentleman.
Thank you very much. It has been reported yesterday that you are willing at this point to meet with leaders of Russia, China, the UK, and France to discuss arms control issues, right, among other things.
They all want to discuss arms control, and that's a wise thing. We're spending now over $20 billion on nuclear and on the super speed missiles and many other things. And
They have come to me, and they all want to now discuss arms control. And that includes China, and that includes Russia. And I think it's very smart of them to want to do it, and I think it's very smart of us to want to do it. And we will be discussing that in New York.
How can you say the market is strong?
One final question. Go ahead.
Washington, please. How do you anticipate troops will be returning? You said, how soon do you see them returning in this U.S.-Taliban agreement? How soon do you expect troops to be coming back?
Today. Okay? Today. They'll start immediately. So, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be doing this quite often. We're going to keep you abreast of all of the facts. And, again, I want to thank the professionals. They are great professionals. I've gotten to really know them and see them under very interesting and tough and trying conditions. We have the finest in the world. I will say this. Other countries call us, and they ask, would it be possible for them to speak to Anthony and Bob and the people that you're talking to on a daily basis now. So we're going to be very transparent. We'll be meeting you probably tomorrow or the next day. We'll keep you abreast. Thank you very much.
Where are we on the numbers to Congress, sir?
Thank you, Mr. President.
Where are we on the numbers to Congress?
Coming up next is Dr. Paul Cottrell, and he's going to describe the virus in terms that are understandable to a layman. And he says it was definitely an engineered virus, this coronavirus, or COVID-19, they're calling it today. But here we go with Dr. Paul Cottrell from Harvard.
Honestly, I prefer I was 100% wrong on the things I'm saying. Because if I'm right, we're talking about serious problems. And I want to be wrong. I really do. I really, really want to be wrong. But it's not coming out that way.
So today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Paul Cottrell. Now, normally when I have a guest on, I like to make a discussion of it, but he has such a large amount of knowledge on the Wuhan coronavirus that I'm going to let him take the floor for most of today's interview. Paul, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I guess we'll start this where it all began. And now you say that the coronavirus did not originate at the Wuhan fish market in December of 2019, like the Chinese and subsequently the world media is reporting. So tell me what seems to make more sense to you.
Okay, we have been trying to use the scientific method, all right? When I say we, I mean my team of little army that's on my channel. But it all started on January 25th, and China released a genome, the Wuhan genome, coronavirus, and I was just going in just for fun to take a look at it. I mean, it was like everything, you just step into it and it just grows and grows and grows and you follow the rabbit hole. But I looked at the genome that was published through the NIH, and there is a process called BLAST, and you can search the database and compare other organisms to either protein sequences or RNA sequences, DNA sequences. So that's what I did. I did a BLAST search on the Wuhan strand just to take a look at it, just for fun. And you can see there's some graphical capabilities of the software in the database, some information about what part of the genome codes for what types of proteins and all this stuff. So when I did that BLAST search, it showed about 20 different organisms that are similar, what we call homology. And it gives you a percentage of the similarities and a graphical representation on which nucleotides are similar where within the genome. This particular genome is about 30,000 nucleotides long, depending on the strain you're looking at, but roughly 30,000. It became very clear to me after 5 minutes of looking at the graphics, the graphical representation, that this was not zoonotic. Zoonotic means that it's from nature, that it naturally evolved in nature. I started to create the hypothesis that, is it possible that this was a bioengineered virus? And we got to remember that bioengineering happens all the time in labs for scientific study to understand processes within the cell In this case, bioengineering really meant supercharging a virus to understand what was going on in the bat host. Why do coronaviruses live in the bat host, and how they evolve into SARS or MERS? So there's many different types of viruses. This particular virus is called the coronavirus, but there's many different coronaviruses. Majority of them are very benign. The common cold is people that get the common cold, one of the viruses that gives you the common cold is the benign form of corona. But there are also deadly ones, like SARS, MERS, and now this Wuhan strand, or what we call COVID-19. So by looking at the graphical database within the NIH, it became very clear to me on the 25th of January and subsequently on the 27th of January that there was bat SARS-like homology and SARS coronavirus homology in the Wuhan strand. There was about 2,000 nucleotide insertion in the replicase area of the genome. The replicase is what allows the virus to replicate its proteins and its RNA for packaging and eventually leave the cell, the exocytosis of the genome, the farther side of the genome. There is something called the S protein, or the spike protein. This is the protein that actually attaches to the ACE2 receptor. There was a large insertion there too, over 500 nucleotides. A few days later, there was a paper that was published by three Indian researchers that was published on Cold Spring Harbor's open source database that HIV and HIV gag homology was in the S protein part of the genome for Wuhan, or what we call now COVID-19. If it wasn't for that paper that subsequently was pulled down off the database, if it wasn't for that paper, I would not have been able to go into the actual NIH database and search for that homology, that HIV homology. So what we have with COVID-19 is this. It was bioengineered with bat SARS-like virus, SARS virus, and HIV homology. Now, it's possible that the HIV homology was zoonotic. Possible. But I don't think it was, but it's possible. But these other insertions are very improbable that they were zoonotic. That it's much higher probability that they were done by human means in the laboratory. So that's looking at it from the bioinformatic perspective. Then if you look at it from just a pure statistical perspective, the chances in nature for a bat in the same cell to have bat SARS-like virus, SARS virus, and HIV virus, and it just translocates, in a way where it supercharges the replicase and supercharges the S protein, is a very low probability. And then you add it to the fact that, well, that bat bit or was sold at the fish market in Wuhan that happens to be 12 kilometers away from the P4 facility. So you add that as a probability, and so you have to take the probability of something times the probability of another thing times another thing and times another thing, and all these function, it leads to something like 0.00001% chance that this was zoonotic. So the story, just from a probability standpoint, doesn't seem right. If you look at it from a bioinformatic perspective, it doesn't look right. Then, if you look at the research, what has been published over the years, and we have been able to track down who really broke the news on this particular piece of the puzzle was Lisa Havens. And Lisa Havens had a video on YouTube that stated Dr. Peng Zhao, so P-E-N-G and then Z-H-O-U, yeah. And he had a team going all the way back to 2010 that was bioengineering bad SARS-like virus and SARS virus and supercharging it to study why it was able to be hosted in bats. So it wasn't nefarious. Just because we say something is bioengineered doesn't mean that it was done for a bioweapon. Most of this is really, you know, for scientific research to design therapeutics and to design the vaccines. But because it's a virulent strand that's bioengineered, it had to be in a P4 or what we call in the United States a BSL-4 laboratory. I suspect that there were poor protocols, safety protocols at the P4 Wuhan facility whereby there was leaks. I don't believe at this moment in time, because there's no evidence, that it was leaked on purpose. But there is, you know, some rumors out there that, you know, that perhaps because it was such a virulent strand for scientific purposes that it could be used as a bioweapon. So people need to understand that what they mean when they say bioweapon. I have this phrase that I try to use as an analogy. You can make a steak knife to cut steak, but you can still kill someone with a steak knife. And that is, I think, what we have here. It could have been used as a bioweapon. I'm not saying it couldn't. I just say that the genesis of this virus was bioengineered for scientific purposes, and it's very, very virulent. So that's kind of like the beginnings of this story. To answer your question on I believe it came from the P4 lab through accidental leaks because of poor protocols.
Dr. Cottrell never makes statements about where he came, originally it came from, but Francis Boyle, being interviewed by Alex Jones, is saying that it came out of North Carolina University and it was sold to the Chinese. That's the best idea that information, in fact, that he has about it. So that's what seems to be, the origin of it, that winding up in Wuhan. And there was a university professor just arrested that had a secret laboratory in Wuhan. And this may be also connected with this virus. And they're surreptitious of marketing it to China for, it's been reported into the billions of dollars. So that could very well have been what was going on. But right now, we have today a upgrade of the condition of the World Health Organization has raised the COVID-19 risk to very high. And we're going to let you listen to that global national clip right now stating that. And that's getting up there. And then we're going to tell you what currently is going on, especially on the West Coast. We've got quite an outbreak that is occurring out there in Oregon and so forth. We've had our first death up in Washington State. So we'll inform you of that. First, we're going to listen to this global national news item announcing the World Health Organization announcing high risk. Here we go now.
On this Friday night, COVID-19, the risk of its spread now upgraded to the highest level.
This is a reality check.
What all countries, including Canada, are being warned to prepare for.
Wake up, get ready. This virus may be on its way.
As fears drive down global stock markets even further. Plus, why we're not getting a true picture of how many people are infected. trying to end the impasse. Fresh talks between Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs and government ministers. A Global News exclusive, how Canadian terrorism offenders are leaving prison still radicalized. And from working the checkout to winning a jackpot. A young supermarket employee bagging a windfall.
Global National with Donna Friesen.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. Countries and companies around the world are focused on COVID-19 tonight as new cases emerge. More than 50 countries have confirmed cases of the new coronavirus now, and the World Health Organization has raised its alert to the highest level. And around there are reports from hospitals of a big spike in deaths, more than 200. That is six times higher than the official death toll from the Iranian Health Ministry. Many believe it's downplaying what's really going on. Mass disinfection is underway at mosques and on public transit. Schools are closed for 3 days, and many flights to and from Iran have been canceled. The World Health Organization now admits we are on the precipice of a pandemic.
This is a reality check for every government on the planet. Wake up, get ready. This virus may be on its way and you need to be ready. You have a duty to your citizens, you have a duty to the world to be ready.
We'll get to what Canadian public health officials are doing to ramp up the response here in just a moment, but we begin with the stock market. It went into a tailspin again today across Asia, Europe, and here in North America. The TSX closed down 454 points, and Wall Street suffered its worst week since the financial crisis of 2008. The Dow Jones tanked today, closing a staggering week with a loss of about 3,500 points in just 5 days. It's all fueled by massive sell-offs and rising uncertainty as multinational companies downgrade their financial forecasts. Production at factories has slowed. That's paralyzing supply chains globally. And as more people stay home, stop traveling, and limit their activities to contain the spread, the pain will get worse. And tonight, in the U.S., the world's second largest economy, the first hotspot for the virus is emerging. Jackson Prosco reports.
California is now the focus of COVID-19 containment in the U.S., where 8,400 people are being monitored for symptoms after a single person tested positive despite having no obvious connection to the virus.
This is a random individual in a community of 450,000 people.
The woman was admitted to hospital not far from a U.S. Air Force base where Americans were quarantined after their repatriation from Wuhan, China. A whistleblower has come forward to say staff on the base who greeted those Americans were not properly trained or protected.
Now that we're seeing it in essentially every continent, there's certainly, I think, a new attention being paid to this infection.
The lack of testing has hampered any clear sense of how widespread COVID-19 may be in the U.S. There are only a limited number of test kits. Many have been deemed faulty or unreliable.
We've been diverted, beginning with that impeachment process, towards they are starting at the beginning of the year. And so we were diverted, you could say, from this coronavirus crisis that had developed, we think, back in December of last year. With the Chinese officials, they thwarted it to begin with, and they were dissing people that were making pronouncements that we had, that they had a problem in Wuhan, and they were dissing the government official were dissing these people, confining them, and declaring that they were trying to be disruptive elements in the government. So it started out bad in China, and that delay increased the probability of people flying in and out of Wuhan, going to all other kinds of countries, foreign countries. And I believe that resulted, then in a spread that possibly wouldn't have occurred. Right now, the West Coast is experiencing some real problems out there in the virus. And we don't see any let up. We're seeing the first death occur in Washington State up there now. And we see another county there in Washington that is breaking out. We see a local spreading of the coronavirus, which means that there's beginning to be a turning point in this of community, transmission. When it begins to do community transmission, then it's hard to pinpoint the origin and stamp out some of the, you could say, the major individuals who are infecting others. See, Trump's recent press conference, I think it was yesterday, was not good in some of their responses that they were saying. Today, they had a little bit better press conference, and it seemed to go a little bit better. But because we have not been testing that well in the last few weeks or month, up to a month, then we have a larger outbreak than has been reported. And this seems to be the problem right now in the coronavirus outbreak in the United States, is that we have a larger outbreak. We were just not aware of it until just recently, see. So anyway, that's all we're going to be talking about on the coronavirus. It is serious. We've got to take it serious. We've got to possibly do home quarantining in the end, toward the end of this, you could say, outbreak. We got to get our hands on it and so forth. And so the next coming up is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking in Qatar. They struck a peace treaty, a peace agreement with the Taliban in Afghanistan. So here we go with Secretary of State Pompeo speaking from Qatar.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is an historic day for the United States of America and the American people. Today we have taken a decisive step toward peace, real peace in Afghanistan. Just as any worthy journey begins, it is a first step. Nearly 19 years ago, America embarked on a noble mission to mightily pursue the terrorist perpetrators of September 11th attacks and their evil supporters, and to prevent such a heinous attack from ever happening again. We've achieved great things. We've ensured Afghanistan isn't a haven for terrorists who can attack us. And we have bettered the lives of Afghan people, for which we are very proud. Today, political debate in Afghanistan is free and vigorous. Today, more than 9 million students are enrolled in school. 39% of them are girls. Today, more than 57% of Afghans have access to basic health care, compared to just 9% in 2002. And Al-Qaeda today is a shadow of its former self. We have decimated its leadership and now have the Taliban agreeing that Al-Qaeda must never again find safe haven in Afghanistan. But just as Afghanistan today isn't the Afghanistan of 2001, the world of 2020 isn't the world of 2001 either. Today, the United States faces national security challenges that weren't even imagined a few years ago. From Iran, from China, from Russia, and elsewhere. President Trump has recognized this new reality. He also saw that our sacrifices and gains in Afghanistan and realized the hard truth that a comprehensive, inclusive, durable peace could only be secured by the Afghan people themselves. Today, we're realistic. We are seizing the best opportunity for peace in a generation, built on the hard work of our soldiers, diplomats, businessmen, aid workers, friends, and the Afghans themselves. Today, we're restrained. We recognize America shouldn't fight in perpetuity in the graveyard of empires if we can help Afghans forge peace. And we have respect. We believe that the Afghan people are ready to chart their own course forward. Today, following the first ever week-long break in fighting in nearly 19 years, I'm proud to announce that the United States has secured separate commitments from the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and the Taliban to hold negotiations for peace. Very importantly, the U.S.-Taliban agreement entails a promise from the Taliban that terrorists can never again operate from Afghan soil. We make no mistake. The chapter of American history on the Taliban is written in blood. They've killed many Americans, NATO allies, coalition partners, and many Afghans. I'm just as angry over 9/11 as I was the day I watched Al-Qaeda knock down the Twin Towers on TV. Our valiant service members, intelligence warriors, and world-class diplomats who have served in Kandahar and in Helmand and all over Afghanistan know firsthand what I mean. They know what I mean exactly. And we know exactly who we're dealing with. If the Taliban do not uphold their commitments, President Trump and his team will not hesitate to do what we must do to protect American lives. If, on the other hand, the Taliban abide by their promises, the United States will undertake a responsible, conditions-based troop withdrawal. That withdrawal means that our men and women in uniform will incur fewer risks, our financial burden will be eased, and our brave troops will return home. This is a hopeful moment, but it's only the beginning. There's a great deal of hard work ahead on the diplomatic front. Finally, let me speak directly to those invested in Afghanistan. First, to America's military and intelligence warriors. I know that some of you may be on your fifth or sixth tours of duty, maybe even more, far from the comforts of home. As the CIA director, it was my honor to join you in dealing blow after blow to this vicious enemy. Many of you wear black and silver bracelets in tribute to your brothers and sisters who died so that your countrymen might live in peace and security. We will not squander what they and you have won through blood, sweat, and tears. You've kept America safe alongside our allies and Afghan partners. You've helped give the people of Afghanistan this opportunity for a brighter future. Second, to our NATO allies and other coalition partners who have sacrificed right alongside of us, we will continue to look to you and to all countries which support these agreements to help maintain this nascent peace. Whether it's Norway or Australia or Japan or any of our other valued friends and partners, we know you share our cautious hope. To Afghanistan's neighbors, including Pakistan, we thank you for your efforts in helping reach these historic agreements and make clear our expectation that you will continue to do your part to promote a peaceful and prosperous Afghanistan so that the country and region can reap the benefits of lasting peace. And to the Afghan people, this is your moment. Wars have tortured your country since 1979. No more violence. No more chaos. Listen to the voices of all, young and old, men and women, from every region, from every tribe, from every ethnicity, and from every religion. Factions will undoubtedly emerge that want to spoil our good work. We must call them out and reject their schemes for discord. I'll close by urging all parties to heed the wisdom of the pursuit of peace that's found in Scripture. Whoever of you loves life and desires to see many good days, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from telling lies. Turn from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Today we've sought peace. We will continue to pursue it. Thank you, and I'm happy to take a few questions.
Thanks. We'll start with Francesco Fantamaghi, AFP.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I wanted to know exactly what will make you stop the withdrawal if the Taliban don't respect their agreement. Is it counterterrorism commitments, or is it the outcome of the negotiations, inter-Afghan negotiation, meaning that the timeline for the complete withdrawal is 14 months? Would they have to complete an agreement, intra-Afghan agreement, by then, or just make progress in their negotiations? Thank you.
So we've spent many months getting to where we are today. And there are a set of interlocking understandings, implementation agreements, that are clearly spelt out. I am confident each party that's been part of this, the Afghan government, ourselves, the Taliban, understands precisely the commitments that they have made and the response, not only the response about the speed and magnitude of the withdrawal of not only American but coalition forces, but the other elements of support that the United States provide. We've made commitments to continue to provide that security assurances for the Afghan government, but it is our very expectation that the Taliban will live up to their commitments. But no one should be surprised. The United States will do whatever it takes to keep the American people safe. And so to the extent the Taliban fail to live up to their commitments, President Trump is as committed to peace as he is to ensuring that the American people never suffer an attack again from Afghanistan.
It's going to remain to be seen whether or not this agreement will hold. There's quite a large obligation that the Taliban have taken on, and so forth. And you've got to look at the agreement. They're to, you know, not support any kind of Al-Qaeda or any other terrorist group in the country, and so forth. So I just don't know if they're going to own up to that. There was another sensational thing about Sanders talking about Cuba. And he said, in an interview, he said, oh, they got that Fidel taught them how to read and so forth. And there's always been this Hollywood love affair with the Cubans, see. This love affair of Hollywood with Fidel, something else. But on the five, Greg Gutfeld had something to say that was very important. Here we go now with what he had to say.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes American journalists talk about how bad a country is because people are lining up for food. That's a good thing. In other countries, people don't line up for food. The rich get the food and the poor starve to death.
That is amazing. Anyway, that was a long time ago. But you might consider how Soviet citizens felt when they heard a free person in a free country papering over their misery, doing publicity for their dictator. So, has Bernie changed much? Has he learned not to minimize the tragedies of totalitarianism? Here he was on 60 Minutes last night.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad. You know, when Fidel Castro came into office, you know what he did? He had a massive literacy program. Is that a bad thing? Even though Fidel Castro did it?
Bernie Sanders is hardcore socialist, possibly communist, you know, period. Someone got to call him a communist. That's what he is, really. He hasn't changed. He spent his honeymoon in Moscow and so forth and so on. Okay. But that he's hardcore. I'm sorry. He's unapologetic. He's apologetic for, he's apologizing for any bad thing they do. Tom Woods had an interview recently with Roberto Fontova, and he was author of Fidel Hollywood's favorite tyrant. And here's what they had to say about that. And then he talked about this Michael Moore medical thing that he portrayed the Cuban medical as a model that we should follow. So listen to this closely.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Well, with the recent death of Fidel Castro, good heavens, Facebook has not been a safe place to be if you have friends across ideological lines, because, oh my goodness, are tears being shed for Fidel Castro, of all people, for heaven's sake. So let's get to the bottom of the true Castro legacy, the true history of Castro, what the whole story was in Cuba, and we're going to do that with Humberto Fontova, who is the author of Fidel, Hollywood's Favorite Tyrant, as well as The Longest Romance, the Mainstream Media, and Fidel Castro. TomWoods.com/797 is where to go to get links to those books. And then stay tuned after my conversation with Humberto. I'm going to add a little bit of additional information I learned from Yuri Maltsev about Castro. But for now, I'm very glad to welcome Humberto to the show. Thanks for being here.
That's why so much BS is believed worldwide about Cuba, starting from the revolution to the healthcare.
Well, let's talk about that, because that's come up quite a bit. And also the literacy rate is supposed to be slightly higher than in the U.S. Now, I'm going to ask you about that. But even if that were true, my view would be, what are they allowed to read? If I were running a communist dictatorship, I wouldn't care if everybody was literate if all they could read was communist propaganda.
No, certainly they're not allowed to read these books. I'll tell you that. My books are obviously banned. But so is the UN Declaration of Human Rights banned. Animal Farm is banned. Folks, I can't stress it enough. It is a Stalinist Iron Curtain regime. In 1958, Cuba had 88% literacy. Now, what you've got to remember is that Cuba had only been an independent nation since 1902. It had been utterly devastated in its war of liberation. Americans know it as a Spanish-American war, but it had actually started several years before U.S. guerrillas, Cuban guerrillas fighting Spain. So Cuba was completely demolished, devastated. In 1902, they get there and they start. So all of these advances that you're going to be hearing about from me took place in a course basically about the same amount of time that Castro's been in power, about 55 years. Cuba had 88% literacy. Cuba spent the most on literacy, on education. You can see from the budget, this is documented in my books, than any country in Latin America. Cuba had a higher standard of living in 1958 than much of Europe. Cubans owned as many cars per capita in 1958 as the fanatical car freaks, the Italians. Cuba in 1958 had almost double Spain's per capita income. It had a higher per capita income than Austria, than Japan. It had a lower infant mortality than France, Germany, and Belgium. And this is documented, by the way, by the United States. And this was at a time when Cuba was not a totalitarian country. So the figures were given to the United Nations by people who were not, did not have a gun to their head, like Batista. As a matter of fact, most of these figures that I'm giving you were being given to the United Nations, and they were given to international institutions by Cubans who were actually anti-Batistas. Most educated, upper-tier Cubans were anti-Batista. My family wasn't. My country was indifferent. Hey, Batista didn't mess with us. You know, it's typical of these so-called right-wing dictators. Like I told Soledad O'Brien last week, she was a guest on MSNBC. She was talking about, I said, who jumped on rafts to escape from Batista? Under Batista's rule in the 1950s, folks, more Americans lived in Cuba than Cubans lived in the U.S. And this was at a time that Cubans could leave Cuba with all of their possessions, get a U.S. visa for the S. Cuba took in more immigrants as a percentage of population before Castro in the 20th century than did the United States, including the Ellis Island years. So we went from being one of the world's biggest magnets for immigrants to one where 20 times as many people have died trying to escape it than East Germany. What more can you say?
How would you account then for – but let's say something about the health situation. Don't they have great free health care?
It's dreadful. In 1958, they had a great base to work on. In 1958, Cuba had the 13th lowest infant mortality on Earth. Nowadays, this is a good example. Most of the doctors or the men who became women who became doctors who had the misfortune of being born in Cuba in the 50s and 60s and got their medical degrees under Castro, when they come to the United States, escaping and otherwise, they cannot pass. They obviously have to be licensed in the U.S. to be practiced. They cannot pass the exam in the United States to be doctors. They can barely pass the one. Most of them flunk the ones to be doctor's assistants. Bottom line, most Cuban doctors, as the media and the UN and liberals call it, barely qualify as U.S. nurses. It is a complete hoax. Let me give you an example of how this works. Remember Michael Moore's Sicko, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah, remember when that movie? Obviously, that was one of Castro's favorite movies. It was shown island-wide for free in Cuba, and Cuban dissidents saw that movie, and they were horrified. They were disgusted. Here we go again. Propaganda, and the world's going to believe this like they believe the rest of the propaganda believe. And don't you know that Cuban dissidents snuck little mini cameras into actual Cuban hospitals? Not the ones that the Communist Party elite and tourists use, but the ones that Joe Sixpack Cuban uses it. Not that most Cubans can even afford a six-pack, but the ones that the regular Cubans have to go, they snuck cameras into, and they snuck out films of a horrible conditions, fly-infested beds without sheets, just horrible, horrible conditions. And they were going to show it on ABC. John Stossel was going to show it back when he was on ABC. And the show is going to be What Michael Moore Didn't Show You. And we all went, wow, wow, this is great. I was getting briefed on this by my friends who are friends with Cuban dissidents. This is going to be great. Well, guess what? The regime got wind of this, and they called in the ABC people in Havana. This is, shows you how they manipulate. And they said, you know, if y'all do this, if y'all show these, we're really going to have to reconsider the renewal of your Havana Journalist Bureau. So in other words, they blackmailed them. They were going to boot them, just like they booted the sensible thing for showing the truth. ABC, John Stossel, caved. They caved. They showed a very sad, they did show a show, but they didn't show the most hard-hitting parts of those films. The dissidents call my friends in Miami and say, Umberto, this is horrible. These dissidents in Cuba generally, literally almost, risk their lives to get these films out. We smuggle them to the U.S., and what's going to happen? ABC caved. I said, hold on for a second, folks. Hold on, but let's not despair. This is 2009-8. Hold on, let me go there. Let me call somebody who doesn't have a Havana Bureau. So I called Hannity's producers, and I called O'Reilly's producers. And they called back immediately, told them what I had. But Hannity's producers called a little quicker, more quickly than did Hannity's. And Hannity showed it, folks. And you can see it, showed it. And you can see it on YouTube. Hannity, What Michael Moore Didn't Show You. But that goes to show you how they manipulate the U.S. media. Fox didn't have a Havana Bureau, so they had nothing to lose. ABC did, so they were going to be a typical propaganda auxiliary of the regime.
In wrapping up this this first hour, is today is the South Carolina primary. Joe Biden is expected to do well in this. What I did pick up just recently from BBC Monitoring, okay? BBC Monitors, I think it's called, is that there was a filing that was done in Kyiv, Ukraine. And it had to do with a filing at the very, very beginning of a criminal investigation on Joe Biden. I picked this up by through Gateway, and then went back to where they to vet it out to where they called it being first broadcast. The article was from BBC Monitoring, I think it's called, and it was there, and it said basically I wasn't able to read the whole article. But basically, he said that a filing had just been done. The Shulkin, Victor Shulkin was the Attorney General of the Ukraine at the time that Joe Biden got him dismissed because he was beginning to investigate Hunter Biden, was the way the story goes. And so, if this is all true, what we're laying out here, but you can check it and go back to BBC Monitoring and see it for yourself. But I picked it up on Gateway Pundits, but they sourced it themselves off of their article back to BBC Monitoring. But BBC Monitoring requires an account with them, and I wasn't able to go back any further than that. So let's conclude our program this evening with a few overall view. The coronavirus is getting worse. There's major breakout occurring on the West Coast. There's the first death in Washington State. There's other reports of other problems in Canada because they have a large Chinese population in Vancouver, if you didn't know that. But they do have a large Chinese population in Vancouver. We have the recent agreement with the Taliban that our United States has made. Pompeo was speaking from Qatar this afternoon, and we have his speech in here in this first hour. I don't know how optimistic I would be about making, you know, an agreement with the Taliban. We do have Joe Biden. If he does not do well in the South Carolina, where he has a large black following and backing, then he's probably out for the race. We have a continued assault being executed against Bernie Sanders. Now, like I said earlier in this program, Bernie Sanders is extreme to the left. He's using the word socialist, but I think communist is a more appropriate, you know, description of his, what he believes in. I mean, he's backing, Venezuela. He speaks, eloquently of Cuba, like we gave tonight, this example of, oh, they taught him how to read. What did they teach the young Cubans to read but propaganda, communist propaganda? And they were outlawed. Anything that spoke about freedom and liberty, Animal Farm, those kinds of books, they were outlawed, in Cuba. And if you got caught with contraband and outlawed publication stuff, probably end up in prison, see, or get shot. Many people were shot and executed by the Fidel brothers and that regime over there. So it was not a nice regime. They didn't do a lot for the people. They put them to work. The income is $10 or $15 a month, maybe. You know, their salaries. They live on a subsistence type of life over there. And when they come here, I've known some Cubans that have come here to the United States. When they come here, boy, they're out there making money in the Miami area. They're all over the place, the Cubans are, and they have businesses, restaurants, and bars and different things, and they're making money. And they're enjoying a higher standard of living and as good American citizens, see. And I remember that the time that Janet Reno had that young boy arrested and taken back to Cuba. I think that was the low point of the whole Clinton administration, as far as I was concerned, see. That should have never been allowed to take that young boy back to Cuba. Under force, by force. And I think that was just a really low point in America itself. I mean, is that what we really stand for? Do we stand for freedom and liberty and democracy and republicanism? Or do we stand for something else other than that? So I just don't see it. And I don't understand exactly everything that's going on in the country. And neither do I really agree with everything that's been going on. Anyway, I want to thank everyone out there for helping support the program. And we broadcast every Saturday night, 7 to 9. And we've been doing analysis of news clips from about everybody. And so anyway, listen in. thesecrettruth.com. We're going to go with a webcast from the university on the coronavirus. That'll be sometime towards the end of March or sooner. And I want to thank each and every one of you for listening. So good night and God bless each and every one of you. And we hope that this country will come out of this dive, this nosedive. Good night.